Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dr. James Tajani on the show. We'll be discussing his new book, A Machine to Move Ocean and Earth, The Making of the Port of Los Angeles in America. Dr. Tajani is a professor of history at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. Here's a description of the book. The Port of Los Angeles is all around us. Objects we use on a daily basis pass through it, furniture, apparel, electronics, automobiles, and much more. The busiest container port in the Western Hemisphere. It claims 1/6 of all U.S. ocean shipping. Yet despite its centrality to our world, the port and the story of its making have been neglected in the history of the United States. In A Machine to Move Ocean and Earth, historian James Tajani corrects a significant omission, charting the port's rise out of the mud and salt marsh of the San Pedro Estuary, and showing how the story of the port is the story of modern globalized America itself. This was a great conversation and a companion to some of the other conversations that I've recently had about the Port of Los Angeles, and I know you'll enjoy it. Let's go meet Dr. James Tajani. Dr. Tajani, can you talk about your earliest experiences of the Port of Los Angeles?
Yeah, the Port of Los Angeles has been a big part of my life going back 4 decades. So my parents moved to Southern California in end of 78. So since 1979. And since I was a child, I just have these very strong visual memories of driving through the port district. And that includes everything from the waterfront of Long Beach and into San Pedro, going over bridges, seeing trains, seeing the trucks, seeing the container ships, seeing giant cranes, just the kinds of things that a young child is fascinated with, looking out the window of a car. And in California, I think that's such a universal experience of being a kid in the back of a car. And the port district extends inland through these giant oil refineries and tank farms. And so there was just so much industrial landscape that I just took in as a child. And then as I got older and I started spending more time at the beaches in the area, because it's a bay and you've got that kind of crescent shape of the coastline, I would be down at the beaches on the southern end of San Pedro Bay and waiting for waves to roll in. And you're out there and you're just looking at these container ships. And that really started to strike me in the years after the WTO, where those container ships, there started to be more of them and they were getting bigger. And I really had a sense like this, something's going on here, the history of which needs to be explained.
Yeah, I feel like I have a bunch of things to say in response. I feel like people tend to associate the Port of Oakland because it's so much more central to that city when you drive past. When you're going across the Bay Bridge, you can't help but see all the ships and the containers and things. And I just don't think people's geographical imagination includes City of Industry and like all these different industrial sites in Los Angeles, and they're what they envision Los Angeles to be. But it's so central because, as you say in the book, and it's the Port of Los Angeles is the biggest port in really this part of the world. And so it really drives the city. And I also had a fascination much later in life. I lived in Stockton for 1 year, and I lived really near the Delta, part of the Delta where a lot of the container ships would go by, and I would walk my dogs and there'd be just this massive ship with containers stacked 10, 15 high, just right next to you, right along the park that I would walk. And it's startling and almost beautiful in a way, and fascinating to see how the world works. We could probably talk about that for a while, but I want to ask you next about your experience of adapting a dissertation into a book, especially a book that you're trying to reach a more popular audience. And your book is dense with material, facts, details, amazing stories. But can you talk about what that adaptation process looked like for you?
Yeah, so it's really, I think the most immediate answer is that it took quite a long time. And so this is a dissertation that I defended in 2009. And so that's quite long for a book and quite long for a first book. And so in a lot of ways, that is not the way to launch an academic career. There's quite a lot of risk in doing that. But I think that happened for a couple of reasons. The first reason, a couple of reasons that ended up being, I think, a blessing. So the first reason was that the story was just incredibly hard to figure out. And especially as characters started to link up and as the story started to expand, initially I began just really thinking this was going to be an environmental history of the area that becomes the port, the estuary, and moving into kind of a story of industrialization and railroads. But as characters started to link up, the story got huge and it ranged into the Southwest and into the Pacific Northwest and to Washington, D.C., and it just grew bigger and bigger. So at some points, I felt like a detective in an old movie putting the red yarn up on the corkboard and trying to figure out just what is happening here. And that took a long time. And then the other part of the process was that I ended up having to rewrite this, I would say, at least four times of moving from the dissertation in the book to complete from scratch rewrites. And that also was a lot of work, but it was also a blessing because I got better with my language. I got clearer in kind of the explanations and the storyline. And the other benefit of that was that I learned more as a teacher about California history. And that's really not to be taken for granted because as a history grad student, you're trained to be a researcher and you're not really trained to teach. And I guess you're trained to learn academic literature, but not necessarily narrative and timelines and chronology, the things that make a strong history class, say, at the high school level. And so it gave me more time to get that under my belt. And so that process was long and difficult, but I think it worked out to my benefit. And one last, I think, benefit to the long, difficult process of writing the book was that it gave me more time for discovery. And I think had the book had to come out very quickly after it was a dissertation, much of the material would have remained hidden. I just wouldn't have had the time to stumble across it. So it was a saga in itself.
Yeah. One of the things that I love about your book is it kind of bridges some domains that we've talked about discreetly on the podcast before. We've talked a lot about what is the West, the history of the West. There's a number of podcasts that come to mind where we talked about how fraught the term is and how it helps us to explain the history of California. Something that we haven't dipped as much into is Pacific history, which I view as becoming increasingly more important and more urgent. The Biden administration calmed down a lot of things, a lot of tensions with China, or at least tried to, and the Trump administration seemingly accelerating them. So the Pacific is becoming this really important place. So I guess my question most broadly is, how do you think about the state of Pacific histories, books written with the kind of vantage point of seeing the connections between East Asia and the West intersecting as it relates to imperial ambitions, et cetera. And then what are some important tools to understand this particular discipline? Because again, we've talked about Western history a lot, and we haven't really talked about Pacific history and what that means necessarily.
Yeah, I've heard you refer on some of your episodes to the Pacific turn in history. And so I gather that's what you're getting at. I think Pacific history it's been developing for decades, initially, I think, as an offshoot of world history and studies of the Spanish Empire, I think is where it touches California. First, you're looking at the old trans-Pacific trade that the Spanish Empire operated. It has started to come into Western history in the last several decades. And I think strongest, both for the maritime kind of angle and labor and migration across the Pacific. And so that really becomes vitally important with the gold rush, the gold rushes, and the railroad economy. So there's very good work that's there. And then that also starts to build, I think, just the narrative of Asian immigration as part of a big central part of Western history. And it's very good work on Japanese American migration and or Trans-Pacific circuits and other parts of South Asia as well. and the Philippines, I should say. And I don't want to leave out any groups, but I think that's where it really first started to develop strongly. And like I said, that has really big implications for how we think about and study the gold rush, where the gold rush happened, and the labor that was necessary to industrialize the West with mines and railroads. I think what I would say is that one thing that Pacific history has struggled with in the context of United States history is really taking this Pacific focus, whether it's maritime or labor migration or ethnic histories, and really starting to connect it into the heart of the American history narrative. And so I think one thing that my book, what I have tried to do with the book, is really talk about how the United States, by the mid-19th century, develops really its formative relationship with the Pacific, which is going to be a relationship of paradox, really at its heart, because I think what the Pacific became to represent, even before the United States had really expanded to the Pacific, as it's looking to Western conquest, it's already has its goal of reaching the Pacific in places like San Francisco Bay, is that this kind of Western Pacific nexus, from the perspective of the East and politicians in Washington and commercial interests in the major urban areas, is that this is a place really where they see being necessary to fulfilling the nation's vision. It's what they would imagine is its destiny to provide material prosperity and democratic politics, to realize that for its society, and to therefore make a prosperous middle class society possible, to make democratic politics possible, but to do this in a way that will hold the society together and evade all the problems that they see developing in Europe over the 18th and 19th centuries. And so the Pacific becomes that place, but it becomes a paradox, because as much as the United States seeks to realize that vision, the Pacific and the West are counteracting that vision as well, and engendering social divisions, political divisions like sectionalism. And to go back to your question, I still think the Pacific functions in that essential way in our day and age, where if you think about the 19th century and the way that land and commercial wealth were really and thought of to be a safety valve, to use their term, I think in our day and age, the Pacific, with the West as the nexus that gives us access to the Pacific, the cheap goods and the kind of free trade ideal that was developed in the 90s and early 2000s, that was a safety valve of sorts as well. And I think that there's many great things that have come out of that for the American people and for American consumers. But I think we're at a point where we can acknowledge that there's paradox here as well, and there's this is has a troubling legacy for the nation. And as you indicated in the question, I think we will be hearing about that in these trans-Pacific economic relationships in the coming years.
Yeah, and that's why I think your book is such a perfect book to come out right now as we're thinking about our relationship to that part of the world from the perspective of the United States. I want to talk a little bit about the contested nature of the history of the port. You have a bunch of different political organizations that have some domains and jurisdictions over this particular area. And I'm curious where you think the biggest divergence in the story you tell of the port is relative to how the port tells its own story. Where do you think is the biggest divergence between those two narratives?
Yeah, this is also a very interesting question. And I think it's always a challenge for a historian and for the history crowd when you run up against a sort of deeply ingrained narrative. And in this case, the divergence is from a narrative that I think has been very carefully curated by the city of Los Angeles and the Los Angeles region, because that narrative meant something very heartfelt and important. So Los Angeles developed its mythology, its narrative about the port, really starting around the turn of the 20th century, when the city wanted to rise as a city, and I think initially rival San Francisco, the San Francisco and the Bay Area generally, and then eventually surpass it, at least in terms of trade and economics and cultural influence, which it certainly did by the mid-20th century. But that booster mythology that goes back to the 20th century really comes from this moment where Los Angeles, I think, had a kind of status anxiety. And so it carefully crafted this narrative about itself as really being a town made by visionary entrepreneurs. And I think what today we would really associate with kind of Silicon Valley, the kind of disruptor business person. And I think that's really going to be the big divergence with my book. And I think that the booster mythology, it certainly still has relevance and it still is written about. And it is important because this was a true aspect of local history. And these were people who they were visionary and they were taking great risks. But I think what that misses and where the divergence is that they certainly were not removed from a larger context of the region and the nation. And I think we have everything to gain by understanding how these figures fit into a larger context, how their opportunities were shaped by larger historical events, both in the West, largely the greater West, back in the East, in the financial centers and the political centers of power, where places where migrants were coming to Los Angeles. And that's what's really interesting is the booster mythology is really shaped by migrants to a place like Los Angeles, but also shaped by the world events. And why I think this is so critical today is that the Port of Los Angeles and the City of Los Angeles, and I think Americans largely, they regard the Port of LA and the Port of Long Beach as America's port. And for it to be America's port and to be shaping America writ large today, it makes complete sense that it was shaped by America writ large in the past. And we need to understand that for it to really be claimed as America's port. And so I think that's really the difference, is really that question of the local story by itself, the local focus, or whether we place it in this larger context of politics, capitalism, and globalism.
Yeah, if you go to any city, they'll have their city motto express how unique they are. And but the
Yes.
truth is that a lot of the cities, the things that they do, they not only repeat but often rhyme. That's pretty normative. And I'm curious too, building on that last question, about the historiography. What was written about the Port of Los Angeles that you did in reviewing the literature before you started writing? How has it been interpreted in the past within your field, within the academic field?
Yeah, so I don't want to cut anybody out, but my sense was that the port had been written about quite well at the local level and by local historians, local presses, very good writers, journalists. It would get written up in the LA Times quite often. And so I don't want to discount any of that. My sense was that both the Port of Los Angeles and Los Angeles generally, they had not been given their due in the academic fields really at all. And so I came at it really with this sense that I was writing at least the origins of the port. I should qualify that. The port comes into historical work, and it certainly came into work on railroads, especially things like the Free Harbor fight from the 1890s. But in terms of the deep origins of the port, where this truly came from in its beginnings, that was absent from the academic literature. And I think from the popular literature as well, because I think the story wasn't traced farther beyond someone like Phineas Banning and his kind of local wagon and shipping operations within the San Pedro Estuary. So what I looked to is I looked to studies of other port areas, and that those were, on one hand, they were further back in the past in transportation history studies that, in one hand, went out of fashion with kind of terms in social history in the 1960s and 1970s. The transportation studies seem to predate that, and very heavy studies of railroads and port development and infrastructure development.
Yeah, that's
So I
what I was
looked
going to
in.
say. When I've read about it before, it's usually in the context of urban history or kind of history of infrastructure and those economics. And I was, yeah, that's what I saw initially as well.
So there's been a turn back to really good studies of infrastructure and urban history, but I don't think it had gotten to the port quite yet. So I think this was a story that was going to get written, especially as current events made the Port of Los Angeles so important. But I was looking to that for inspiration. I looked to environmental histories for and I looked to histories of capitalism for inspiration, and especially Western capitalism and Western industry. And then the more recent studies of sectionalism and civil war in the West, that was a very recent influence, but I'd say in the last 10 years that became an added inspiration in the academic literature as well. And I know you've had some of those authors on your show, but I owe a big debt to them as well.
Yeah. One more kind of table setting before we jump into a few topics in the book I want to cover. I think when people generally, when they're reading about the history of a place, I think when they visualize it is as it is now and then retroactively place that on. But this, when you're starting the book, mid-19th century, Los Angeles Basin looked totally different. There wasn't the dam infrastructure. It was a very different place. So, could you describe what Los Angeles was in some ways? Because it's hard to unsee what you've seen and try to visualize a place that looked wholly different than it looks now.
Yeah, so Los Angeles, as you suggested, it had neither the sort of the natural resources nor the buried kind of mineral resources to suggest that this was going to grow into a large metro area. And in the Spanish period and all the way through the Gold Rush period, this is a minor outpost of kind of settler society. Now, it was a quite densely populated native society under with the Tongva or the Gabrielino Tongva. And so the natural resources supported quite a lot of density. I think in the book, using other sources, estimated at about 5,000, which is quite dense for Native America. But without the timber, without the agricultural lands and the water, or sufficient water, and being peripheral to the gold rush, as of the 1850s, Los Angeles is only a couple thousand people. And that really pales in comparison to San Francisco, Sacramento, the areas where you are in the foothills. And if you can picture that, then you move out to San Pedro Bay, and San Pedro Bay is an outpost of an outpost. And that's a very important part of the story because it is going to linger as a sort of a viable operating Mexican era rancho quite late in the 19th century, really all the way to the point to where the port begins to be actually developed by the federal government. The Dominguez Rancho San Pedro is able to survive because it's an outpost of an outpost. And so there is a lot of the nature is extant and surviving, grasslands, marshes, and this coastal estuary is surviving. And I think that's going to make it different than coastal lands in a place like San Francisco Bay, where you get very early on because of the gold rush, you get real estate booming and speculators seeking to develop waterfront where ships can dock and reclaiming, and even reclaiming in ways that are going to be detrimental to maritime traffic later, but they're moving on that so quickly, whereas at San Pedro Bay, it's lingering in its somewhat natural state quite late in the game. And that's
Yeah.
important to the story.
Yeah. Let's jump into the book. I've got a number of kind of thematic topics I want to discuss. The first one is about cartography and maps. I think a lot of us in our high school or undergraduate education probably encountered the famous map in the Scramble for Africa, where some men sit in a room and draw lines across a continent and shape continental conflicts for the next, I don't know, 100 years, something like that. And then we all, but I don't feel like we've really covered on this show before the purpose and function of surveyors and how they were an instrument of empire. So I would, because we're going to talk about, shoot, sorry, his name is escaping me. We're talking about George Davidson here in a second. But as a prologue to that, if you could talk about what the role of surveyors were generally within the context of continental expansion and empire in the United States.
Yeah, I think surveyors of the time are these, they're a sort of underappreciated agent of empire. And with Davidson, I begin the book talking about what a how he defies our images of the conquest of the West. He's this unlikely invader. And I think he is really emblematic of these kind of these jack of all trade scientists who either are working for the government or they're licensed by the government as US surveyors, or they're in the army. And they are critical to this process of conquest because conquest is going to require both on the sort of local level, the micro level of individuals, but even on the level of states and government, it's going to require you to understand the landscape, to understand its resources, to wrap your head around distances and, you know, how big is a parcel of land and where are its borders. And for someone like Davidson, that you start to get in the aggregate of that, where you're moving even beyond land claims and who has it and where's Indian land begin and end versus settler land that's been ceded. But for Davidson, you're moving into that large scale sense of space and distance that the United States government needs both to actually claim the land against any kind of rival, which would include Native American nations at the time, but even other nations like Britain, or Mexico. The US government really needs to know, where are these boundaries? How do we avoid getting into a war that we don't want to get into? Because war is expensive and costly. And so scientists like Davidson are there to place that sense of space and understand it in the big picture. And the scientific challenge for them is the fact that maps are flat and two-dimensional, but the Earth is not flat and two-dimensional. It's three-dimensional, it's curved, and it's imperfectly curved. It's inconsistently curved. And how to measure, they're measuring the Earth in three dimensions without any digital or satellite technology to help them. And so that involves an incredible amount of know-how, very meticulous work, a mind for mathematics that I think we, even the best engineers today, can would, I think, struggle to contemplate, because every calculation has to be done by hand and rechecked 10 times to make sure that you root out the errors. And so Davidson and the United States Coast Survey, the agency that he works with, and his boss, Alexander Dallas Bache, they are working to create that long distance map of the United States. And that has an additional motive in the story as well, which is that the United States, as I think you've mentioned on your show, it is a collection of states at the time. It's an agglomeration. In many ways, unity is a unity on paper in the Constitution. And scientists like Davidson and Bache, they have this sense that in order to unite those fragments, you need maps. You need to define the space. And they are living in a world where space and distance is increasing, scale is increasing, and with it, the need to wrangle that space into very definable, precise pieces, so that it doesn't spin out into chaos. And so I think that is why the mapping, particularly of the 19th century, is so critically important to the kind of the expansionist narrative, the narrative of global imperialism and the process of imperialism and discovery. And for us US historians, it's vitally important to this project of actually having a unified nation. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, if folks are interested in thinking about this conceptually, we just lost him, but James C. Scott just passed away, and his book, Seeing Like a State, I think really captures like what it means for the government to organize the world and for imperial powers to visualize and categorize in a way that's taxable, if you will, and what that does to how we change our perception of space. Now, another thing that the government does is it creates laws and legislation to manage conflict, which is what is central in your book, Property Rights. Now, in through your research, how we know the US's terrible history of creating cynical treaties with indigenous nations that were not intended to be followed through by the government, or were just treated with neglect and allowing settler vigilantes to do what they will. In light of all that, how do you think about California's legislation, your Land Act of 1851? How do you think about that cynically? Do you think about it because there was a process that resulted from it in the Rancho San Pedro, but how do you think about it more broadly in the context of this book?
So I try to, I think, balance my cynicism and to balance the cynicism by thinking about these laws and treaties in their most practical sense as a political act, an act of statecraft, and an act of politics, where people's reputations, legislators' reputations were tied up in these laws and treaties. And I think the cynical understanding laws and treaties, I think it has an important place in explaining that the United States and I think settler societies even before European settler societies moving into the North American West, I think they had every sense and intention that they were eclipsing what had existed there before, that they that is something they wanted, that's something that they believed would happen, and they came up with the rationales that for why that would happen, that the land would eventually be, in the US context, that it would be overwhelmed by a kind of energetic American settlers and industrious settlers. But I think that also needs to be countered against a sense that, at least in that the middle decades of the 19th century, the United States, it had to manage chaos and the very real possibility of the West descending into chaos. And I think the possibility that we know the outcome of the story, but they don't, which is that this land had changed hands several times, and it certainly could have again, had the United States made a mistake in kind of its claim to the continent, and especially the Western continent. And so I think that is really where the narrative about the mapping and the attempt to overcome fragmentation, I took it very much on its face, that this was a very real geostrategic concern of the United States. And things like the Land Act of 1851 operated somewhat similarly. I think the speculative land grab kind of motive is always there. And there's characters in the book, I think, that really show that
Absolutely.
they're there to get rich, but they need it to happen in a way that doesn't implode and that isn't chaotic and that isn't a political failure. And I think the character William Gwynne, Senator William Gwynne, the California U.S. Senator, he's a good indication of that because he needs this to work. And he needs it to work both for his reputation in the United States Senate as a up-and-coming mover and shaker and an expert on Western California issues, but he also needs it to work because it's part of his political system of patronage in the state. And wealthy Mexican American landowners, at least I would say through the 1850s, they are an important part of that coalition, that constituency in the Democratic Party. And so while Gwynne, I think, wants land transferred to United States settlers, his time frame for that isn't immediate. And I took that very seriously. He, I think, wanted to see he wanted to see some land loss by indigenous people, certainly, and by Mexican Americans, certainly. But he needed that to happen in an ordered way that still made him look like a successful politician and political kingmaker in the state. And so I think that's not the full totality of the story, but I think it indicates to us that there's cynicism, but there's also more going on than the cynicism that helps us understand the story and why the story just it's so complex and there's always things can be true in the general sense, that the narrative of land loss can be true in the general sense, and yet there's always going to be information that is anomaly that sort of defies our logic. And so we can never, and we should never get too comfortable in that logic. And we should look for the twists and the different narratives and the new narratives. And so Gwynne very much illustrated that to me, as well did someone in his patronage system, Edward Ord, as well.
Yeah, you have a fun collection of characters in the book. Some I'd heard of, and some were introductions. One that a lot of us probably have heard of is Colas P. Huntington, who played a major part in this story. And we're going to fast forward to the 1890s now. I have a pretty simple question, which is, why do you think Huntington lost? And how would LA have been different if Santa Monica had been the location of the port and not San Pedro?
This is a hard question. I did not become an expert on the mind of Colas Huntington, but from reading very good studies of kind of the late period Southern Pacific Company, my sense was that Huntington and the Southern Pacific, they have a peak moment in California history where they are really the government of the state, the invisible government. And that, I think, comes out of the way that the Civil War really shuffled political and economic opportunity in the state. And Huntington and Stanford, who you featured on the show, they navigate and they calculate really well in that moment. I think their unionism was true, right? I think they certainly sided there, not just out of a business move, but the business move paid off and the political move paid off. And from the 1870s into the 1890s, through the 1880s, the Southern Pacific is really at its peak influence politically and economically in the state. And it just dominates rail traffic, and it is the largest employer and the largest landowner. And so many of the legislators, local level, state level, even to the federal level, are somehow on its payroll or getting some sort of material benefit. I think that really helps explain why they become so dominant. And then, of course, they're very good at intimidating local communities, especially in the San Joaquin Valley. And Los Angeles is part of that as well. But why I think that starts to come undone, to answer your question, is on one hand, I think the political apparatus, voters, political parties, government, they are evolving and adapting in a sort of a dialectic, or at least co-evolving with the railroad. And so I think that always would have happened, that there were politicians who their political opportunity eventually came in getting concessions from the railroad, especially as more voters came in, as more economic development came into their cities, as voters started demanding things of them. I think that political challenge of reform was coming. And I think what an interesting question is why it takes so long to come. But I think it was always there. And it certainly is it's part of the Working Men's Party in the 1870s. It's part of the redrafting of the California State Constitution in 1879. It doesn't work, but it was there. So I think that impulse was rising and was going to rise. I think that the other part of the story in this kind of dynamic of coevolution is that the Southern Pacific, having such early success, just as reformers were bound to keep emerging, the Southern Pacific was bound to start to make mistakes from its early success. And I think that started to happen, and it started to happen particularly as the company and the Big Four got so wealthy and as they got older. And some of the literature I saw explained things like the Free Harbor fight, Huntington's loss, simply out of the fact that he was much older than he was now, and he didn't have the energy or the ability to calculate quite as shrewdly as he did in his younger days, or at least as ruthlessly. That's part of it. But I think the X factor is the Federal Army Corps of Engineers, that once you start to get the Fed involved, which they hadn't been involved in before in this question of reform in California, now you're starting to deal with a new, much more powerful player. And I think that just like California reformers were eventually going to find a way to take on the Southern Pacific, I think the same is true of our reformers and our scientific expertise at the federal level, that eventually it was going to be in their interest to challenge this company in the places where it was dominant. In the case of my story, it's the waterfront, it's these harbor areas. Certainly the same thing happens in the Bay Area, and I would guess in other areas of the Western coast. But I think Huntington, his old system of political influence in Washington was going to meet its match, especially taking on things like the Army and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Yeah, let's talk about estuaries for a minute. Estuaries are some of the most important places in human history. You think about early times, prehistoric times, estuaries were places where there was teeming wildlife, food to be gathered. That's why a lot of native people lived in estuaries. But then there also became highly contested places where you could change the landscape quite easily by removing water. Can you talk about the Because we've talked about Phineas Banning a little bit in his early, we didn't reference his early dredging efforts, but those were, I guess you could call more DIY or more a small scale. But once you have the Army Corps of Engineers, they're gonna operate a little bit more in a macro scale and can do a lot more damage just by the tools that they're using. So can you talk about some of the environmental impacts of what happened in terms of dredging and actually just maybe for people, just the process of how they dredged?
Yeah, it's a, I think, a very underappreciated technological revolution of the late 19th century is this ability to manipulate waterscapes. Now that, of course, humans had been doing that back into the ancient world, pulling out rocks, using axes and hand labor to deepen water.
Aqueducts in Rome, the Indus River Valley
Yes.
civilization.
Yeah,
Absolutely.
very good. Yeah, human civilization in many ways starts. It's no accident around these river valleys that are going to start to be used and manipulated by humans. But what you get in the 19th century is the application of industrial technology and industrial scale to that question, with first with steam engines and then eventually with gasoline power and turbine engines. And this is another, I think, another case where you see this coevolution of private industry, railroads getting faster, more efficient, and government starting to invest in these technologies for to increase its stake in these places where it has an interest, and then event and also develop new military and weapons technology. So you have these two rising kind of institutions of modern life. Capital and state investing heavily in technology, looking to the entrepreneurial and inventor sector for new technologies. And in the case of my book, it's really the development of this hydraulic or suction dredging technology, which was a vast improvement over the prior generation of kind of steam-powered, soot spewing, scooping dredge technology, kind of, I guess, what we would still see today in a construction site. So they started to develop that, and the Suez Canal is developed using those scoopers. But the problem with many waterscapes was that they were too, the sediment flow was too rich, to where scoopers really were not efficient. You could scoop something out, but the sediment would be replenished so quickly. You just could not get rid of the sediment quickly enough to actually deepen the spot on a la the waterscape on a lasting level. And so what suction dredges are going to do, they're going to allow that scale, and they're going to allow a kind of constant removal of sediments. And that's going to be critically important in places like the Mississippi River. It's going to be critically important in some of these California rivers that were damaged by hydraulic mining and the Delta. And then it's going to really open up the kind of sand bottom set areas of coast. So sand beaches and coastal estuaries, whether they're small, like San Pedro, relatively small, or huge, like the San Francisco Bay complex of estuaries. And a hydraulic dredge is just like a vacuum cleaner that is just sucking these sediments out. It has mechanisms to pulverize hard rock when it encounters that as well, or boulders. And it just sucks it out through an exit pipeline, and that can run 24/7. It needs very little maintenance, very little visual kind of operation. And they just set loose these dredgers on these spaces, and they can, so these spaces that were previously under the old technology, kind of the hardest to develop, now become the easiest to develop.
Yeah, I've
And
actually
we,
been talking about this recently because we have a lot of discussions, at least in the political domain, about how do we improve the processes for development because we have a housing crisis in California. And often the villain is environmental impact reports. And I tend to agree that we don't need many of those. Maybe one or two would be sufficient, not four or five. But I think reading about the history of how landscapes were destroyed through just blunt instrument development, where you're just sucking everything in and destroying, making the water contaminated and destroying aquatic life and ecosystems that are important for the future of the California coastline. I think you can understand why those things are in place and it makes a lot of sense. And I think that's something that's important to remember as we're trying to build more, is that stories like yours are also illustrative of why those things are important too, and finding the balance between protecting our environment that supports our life, while at the same time trying not to stand in the way of building additional housing for people.
yeah, and wetlands, marshlands, coastal estuaries in the West, these are really underappreciated ecosystems. And there's been more talk about them in the Southeast with sea level rise and hurricanes. But California, we certainly are going to be dealing with that, those large environmental issues as well. But I definitely encourage listeners, go out and see these ecosystems because they are often places we don't go. We drive by them, say in the Delta, and or we view them as wastelands, but they are incredibly important ecosystems.
Yeah, I think the Delta is one of the most underappreciated treasures in California because it's something not many people will drive to the Central Valley to go to a wetland, but like there, it's an incredible place that is stunning visually when you drive through it and really explore all these channels. Let's do a 20,000-foot perspective. I ask all my guests about how their particular research and the manuscript that they produced changes the way they see the history of the state. So for you, conducting the research on the Port of Los Angeles, thinking about it from, from early days to as an economic beacon for Los Angeles, how has all that research changed your perspective on the history of the state?
Yeah, I think that what changed in my perspective, in some ways, it's not quite a change because I've been a proud Californian since my parents moved me here at the age of three. But I think I really came to appreciate and believe that the future of the United States, and I think ultimately what the United States will mean as a human experiment, as an experiment in society and politics, I think in many ways is going to be defined by places like the Port of Los Angeles, California places, and how we manage them, how we manage our material desires in relation to these spaces, how we manage our political goals, our democratic goals, and how we manage our intentions versus unintended consequences. And so I really came away with that sense that the future is being defined in California, but specifically in these kinds of places that have such a profound effect on the socioeconomic foundations of the country. And I think that what that really did is it focused my pride, my previous pride as a Californian, it focused it in very specific things to look for and to watch for as the metrics of where the country's headed and what the American story may ultimately mean.
Okay. We always close this podcast with my favorite place, which is book recommendations. What are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners?
Yeah, so having listened to your show, I really felt behooved to take those recommendations in a new direction. So
Okay.
there's great literature in Californian Western history and US history as well that I won't repeat, but it's definitely good, and your listeners should check that out from other episodes. What I would recommend to your listeners is I think as California and Western interested history people, we certainly should read in those areas, but we also should read broadly. And a couple titles that I found useful both in my project and just thinking about California history. One is Christopher Clark's Revolutionary Spring, a recent book about the 1848-49 revolutions in Europe.
Ooh, have you finished that? I've been plodding through that for months. It feels like that tome.
It is a big book, and I have not finished it.
Yeah, I'm working on it too.
But it was very useful to me in thinking about the larger context of the gold rush,
Yeah.
and particularly.
That's amazing. I hadn't even made that kind of connection in my brain, at least initially when I picked up the book to connect those. But yeah, you're totally right.
What an amazing set of years, the 1848-49 world over. And I searched my mind for something similar, and I think there are things that are that rank on that list, but 48-49, and with California's connection to the gold rush, what a time to live through. So that's one I would recommend, and hopefully you and I both get through it at some point.
Yeah.
And in that vein, I would also say, with the interest in railroads, the great LA Times columnist Michael Hiltzik wrote a book called Iron Empires. And why I think that is useful is it follows the eastern side of the transcontinental story after the railroads built and all the way into the early 20th century when people like Edward Harriman come to dominate the eastern network and then come back into California by buying the Southern Pacific Company. But I think that those are two halves of a story that should be understood. We should enjoy the stories about Huntington and Stanford, but we should also see that other half and where did that go? That's a very interesting story. So check that out if your listeners are interested. And then another large book that I worked through over the summer and need to finish is John Meacham's biography of Abraham Lincoln. And I think to me that got at the heart of what we love about US and California history. And that is this sense that we are trying to connect a moral and a political existence here in the United States and in California. And I would say no book reminded me of that more than this biography of Abraham Lincoln. It's Abraham and There Was Light, Abraham Lincoln and the American Struggle.
Is that a recent one? Did that one come out recently?
2022, I believe.
Oh, okay. Fantastic. Yeah, that's my favorite holiday activity when I'm away from school is getting some big biographies that have been sitting on my desk just staring at me. I'm hopeful that I'm going to finish that Revolutionary Spring over the holidays, but we'll see. Last question for you, Dr. Tajani. What are you working on next?
That's a good question. Yeah, so I would say that in my book, I did not intend it this way. I never thought I would be writing a book that featured characters and kind of biographies, even though my book's not a biography, but there are biographical elements. And as I found these characters, I became fascinated by some of them. And I think their stories, my book was not able to get the full picture of their stories. And so, a couple of these characters, I would be very interested in pursuing more biographical work on them. And I think listeners and readers, if once you pick up the book, you'll know who they are. So I'll leave it at
Yeah,
that.
no, it's very clear as you read. There's fascinating people in these early days. And that's always a curiosity to me when I'm reading these kind of large books and I encounter some character and then I do a little spiral to see if someone's written a kind of a standalone life or a critical biography. And I'm always like, God, I would love to hear the full scope of their narrative and their story. So I'll be looking forward to that. Dr. Tajani, again, the book is A Machine to Move Ocean and Earth, The Making of the Port of Los Angeles in America. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Jordan. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.